Which is to say, and of course I could take off on something else, but I'll save that. Which is to say that with this good Canaanite name, the founder of Babel, Erech, and Akkad may well have been a Canaanite. I mean, that's on page 277. Took those scientists that long to find out that Genesis says in the sixth chapter, chapter 10, the sons of Ham, Cush, and Mizraim, and Phut and Canaan, and the sons of Cush, Seba and Havilah, and Sabta and Raamah, and Sabtachah, and the sons of Raamah, Sheba and Dedan, and Cush beget Nimrod. Now, Cush and Mizraim and Phut and Canaan are the sons of Ham. I have an idea. They all spoke the same language as their dad. I mean, that's the way it normally works, doesn't it? I mean, I don't know any father that teaches his son to speak a language that the father can't speak. Anybody know anybody whose kid has been taught by their father to speak what the father doesn't speak? They finally have found one city in Eblah that no doubt the sons of Ham founded, because we know the Canaanites are there. And they come to the brilliant discovery. Well, what do you know? Nimrod must have spoken the same language as Canaan. Bible keeps coming out, doesn't it? City of Nimrod. End of parenthesis. This biblical site, as he writes, seemed to provide him... What are you trying to do? Get the names of my books? I don't care who knows. It's the archives of Eblah, an empire inscribed in clay. Giovanni Pettinato, with an afterword by Mitchell Dayhood. And it is... The bookstores are getting full of the works that are coming out of Eblah. This one happens to treat the archives. There are many other things found, but the big find in Eblah is the archives, the library, the greatest wealth of inscriptions ever found. 1975! We're back in the 1860s. This biblical site, as he writes, is the link of the cradle of the human race. Cush, as we're told in the 10th chapter of Genesis, was a son of Ham whose father was Noah. Then he quotes the Bible. Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. His pitifully inadequate funds being eaten up, Lyard had no choice but to turn back and go to Constantinople. He was able to get 60 English pounds, as I read earlier, and go back in 1845. He went down the Tigris on a riverboat to begin his excavations at the mound of Nimrod. This time it was not just lack of financial backing that jeopardized his expedition. 5 years had slipped away, and the whole region had become alive with insurrection. The land between the two rivers at this time was under Turkish control. A new governor, or pasha, had been appointed since Lyard's previous visit. And I'm getting back to the place where I left us off. I read this before, but I'm skipping along to catch up. Here's the one-eyed pasha. It seems to have been characteristic of Oriental viceroys to regard territories in their charge as arenas of exploitation, and the inhabitants as so many cows. The new governor of Mosul ruled in true Asiatic style. On this point, the many descriptions of his regime all agree. The pasha was a storybook villain. Even in physical appearance, he fully looked the part. Now, I'm reading. You can buy it if you want. God, Graves, and Scholars, C.W. Saram. It's in paperback, so no sense buying the hardback. Why read it? I'm just picking the best parts out. The Pasha was a storybook villain. Even in physical appearance, he fully looked the part. For example, he had only one eye and one ear. He was small and fat in an insidious way. To make matters worse, his face was covered with pockmarks. He had a terrifying voice. His gestures were uncouth and jerky. He habitually wore a mistrustful look, as if he momentarily expected to be ambushed. He was a clever sadist, gifted with a macabre wit. One of his first actions upon taking office was to institute a tooth tax. This tribute went the European salt tax one better. Its purpose, the Pasha announced, was to cover the attrition of his teeth and for extractions of the same. In short, because his teeth went bad, he had to have some of them pulled. That, he said, was occasioned by the eating of the miserable diet in this benighted land he had to rule over. He taxed everybody else for their teeth. Now, the IRS never been that bad. I mean, if the treasury or the treasurer has a root canal or a cavity, that becomes the excuse to tax everybody. The tooth tax was a mere preliminary to what followed. He made the people shake in their shoes. His method was to despoil the cities he robbed, villages he casually set on fire for the fun of watching them go up in smoke. Despotism always breeds rumor. The news service of the week. One day somebody in Mosul spread the story that Allah was fed up with the odious Pasha and was going to take measures to take him down a peg or two. I'll be done by midnight. You just watch. I'm going to find you a tribe tonight. A few hours later, the governor himself got wind of the story and was inspired by it to invent a stratagem that might have been taken from old Italian novels, for there are similar anecdotes there. The next time the governor went out for a drive, he ostentatiously announced that he felt sick. He was hurried back to the palace, apparently in a state of collapse. On the wings of... Now, some of you reading along with me find I put words in and out different. I improve it a little as I go along. On the wings of hope, eyewitnesses report this interesting development. It flew throughout Mosul. He was sick. The rumor went. During the next few days, the palace gates remained closed. Then the monotonous death wail of the lifeguards and eunuchs resounded from within. The people, pricking up their ears, began to shout with joy. Allah be praised, they roared, the Pasha's dead. Howling and hooting and screaming, wishing the supposedly defunct tyrant into the lowest depths of hell, a crowd gathered in front of the palace. The gate suddenly swung open, and there stood the Pasha. Small, fat, loathsome, a patch over his blind eye, face like a calendar, grinning with malice, a nod, and soldiers rushed upon the terrified crowd. A cruel revenge was now carried out. Heads rolled, and the Pasha's sadism also took a pecuniary turn. He dispossessed all rebels who had anything to lose, not exempting properties previously immune. He did this because, he said, his victims had spread rumors that injured the Turkish authority. At last, the tribes in the desert country about Mosul rebelled against this. Incapable of organized insurrection, they matched pillage with pillage. No road was safe. In consequence, no foreigner sure of his head. And it was in the midst of this hurly-burly that Layard landed in Mesopotamia, hoping to excavate the great mound of Nimrud. Layard quickly sized up the situation. A few hours after arriving in Mosul, he realized that the best policy was to keep his archaeological plans to himself. As a subterfuge, he bought heavy caliber rifles and a short spear, saying he was going down into the river bottoms to hunt wild boar. A few days later, he hired a horse and rode out alone in the direction of Nimrud, which also meant toward a village populated by thievish Bedouins. Now the improbable. How many times have you heard the improbable? I'm telling you, if it was God's time at the turn of the century, 1800, everything starts happening. A few hours after arriving in Mosul, he realized, no, to keep his plans to himself. Now the improbable came to pass. By evening, he had won the friendship of Awad, the tribal sheikh who ruled the roost in the territory immediately surrounding the mound of Nimrud. Put your bets on that. Indeed, by the time he lay down to sleep that night, he'd hired 6 Arab laborers from the sheikh. On the morrow, Awad promises they would help him find what was in the belly of the mountain for a delightful, modest wage at that. Lawyer'd spent a sleepless night. Tomorrow would prove his luck. Tomorrow. No, several months. Maybe that. He remembered how long Bada worked. Actually, it turned out, Lawyer'd struck into the walls of 2 Assyrian palaces before 24 hours had passed. Do you realize how many centuries it had laid there and he hit it in 24 hours? By early dawn, he was roaming the mound. Everywhere he saw inscribed bricks. Awad, the Bedouin sheikh, pointed out to his newly won friend a piece of alabaster sticking in the ground. And this very simply decided the problem where to dig first. 7 men turned to and dug a long trench in the mound. They found alabaster slabs that had been buried in upright position. They proved to be parts of a frieze or a painting, the decorative insides sheathing of palace walls. The richness of the decoration indicated the walls could belong to nothing less than a royal palace. Immediately, Lyard divided up his gang of workmen, fearing they might be overlooking more profitable diggings. He put 3 of his men to work on the other side of the mound. Immediately, they hit a wall covered with slabs showing carvings in relief. Lyard had found the corner section of a second palace. Luck? Listen to his own description. The subject on the upper part of number 1 was a battle scene. 2 chariots drawn by horses richly caparisoned, with each occupied by a group of 3 warriors. The principal person in both groups was beardless. He was clothed in a complete suit of mail, wore a pointed helmet on his head. He describes all this. Now, bas reliefs of this kind are found today everywhere in the museums of Europe and America. As a rule, the visitor gives them a glance and then moves on. But these works of art really deserve close attention. They're so realistic in detail that the examination of a dozen or so of them affords a deep insight into the life of the period, particularly into the lives of the tyrants who are the object of violent biblical stricture. Today, in the age of photography, countless pictures give a superficial idea of what he had. But at the time when Lyard was toiling amid the desert dust on the mound of Nimrud, no exemplars were available but those which Bada had dug up at Nineveh and shipped to Paris. These were new things. Mesopotamia, one must realize, was rediscovered almost at one stroke. In 1843, Rawlinson was hard at work in Baghdad, deciphering the Behistun inscription. The same year, Bada began his excavations and uncovered Nineveh. In 1845, Lawyer was digging at Nimrud. How interesting. All at once, after centuries of being hidden, the decipherment of the Behistun inscription alone yielded more information on the Persepolitan rulers, and Persepolis was the summer palace over to the right of the Persian Gulf, off out of Babylon where the kings went. Now, the decipherment on those inscriptions yielded more information on the Persepolitan or Persian rulers than all the authors of antiquity taken together had been able to supply. One dig, one inscription deciphered, the one that Rawlinson went down and we just read him taking pictures of, the 4 Orientologists were tested on their ability to read it. That one inscription revealed more than all the historians for 2,000 years had been able to say about Assyria. Today, without exaggeration, we can say that we know more about the history of Assyria and Babylonia, about the rise and decline of such cities as Babylon and Nineveh, than did the learned men of classical antiquity, more than all the Greek and Roman historians who were closer in time to the subject by some 2,000 years. Now, the Arabs who daily saw Lawyer Delight in chipped alabaster slabs and scored bricks thought he was stark raving mad. But so long as he paid wages, they were ready and eager to dig. Still, no pioneer in archaeology, and Lawyer's no exception, was ever able to complete his work without an interruption. One day, when the excavations were considerably advanced, when almost any hope, however vaulting, seemed justified, and the shortest breathing spells an intolerable waste of time, Awad, the Arab sheikh and Layard's friend, called him to one side. In his hand he held a little figure covered with gold foil. Slyly hinting his willingness to play along, with much circumlocution and with many appeals to Allah, that's beating around the bush, and appeals to Allah, he made it clear that he knew what the Honorable Frank Layard was really searching for. Of course, he wished Layard good luck. If there was gold in the mound, well and good. All that he asked was a little for himself. He and Layard, would have to watch their step. These donkeys of workmen had no idea about keeping their mouths shut. Above all, news of Lawyer's successes must never get to Muhammad Pasha in Mosul, the one-eyed one. Awad extended his arms full length to show how large the Pasha's ears were. Indeed, he said, Pasha not only has large ears by the thousands, all his senses are multiplied by the sums of the senses of all creatures serving him blindly. In no time at all, the Pasha began to show an interest in Lawyer's activities. An officer with soldiers appeared on the scene. Now we're where I left off. The officer made a token inspection of Lawyer's trenches. He dropped hints that he knew all about the gold that cropped up from time to time. Then he ceremoniously delivered an order from the Pasha, forbidding further excavation. We can imagine how Lawyer, inclined to be upset by the slightest delay, reacted to this prohibition. He swung up on his horse, rode at top speed to Mosul, requested an immediate audience with the Pasha. His request was granted. Thereupon, Lawyer was given a lesson in Oriental deviousness and chameleon shifts of color. The Pasha lifted deprecatory hands. Naturally, he would do everything, but everything, to help Lawyer. He liked French, that is. He admired them, honored them as a people. He was anxious to be honored by their friendship. Today, tomorrow, his whole life long, until Allah called him away. But digging, that was really another matter. Impossible. The site, Lawyer should understand, was an old Mohammedan burial ground. Now, the Frank really ought to look around a little more carefully. He'd find the gravestones. In the eyes of all true believers, Lawyer, sad to relate, and though the Pasha wants to help him, Lawyer, in the eyes of all true believers, was endangering his life and committing a sacrilege. The Pasha couldn't help him. If he kept digging, the faithful would rise against the foreigner, and also against the Pasha for allowing it. If that would happen, it'd be too bad. The Pasha would no longer be able to hold a protecting hand over his friend, from foreign parts. Isn't that nice? Lawyer's visit was humiliating, got him exactly nowhere. Seated one evening in front of his little hut, Lawyer had to admit to himself that the whole project was in danger of collapse. Having returned from his audience with the Pasha, he had ridden over the mound to see whether it was true, as the tyrant had said, that Mohammedan tombstones were located there. And sure enough, there they were. The first one of these tombstones that he found, it was in an isolated spot, had aroused his suspicions of what to do. He was still pondering what move to make next when he went to bed that night. A mistake, he thought grimly, not to have noticed the gravestones and not to have discussed the matter more carefully with the Pasha while he was at the palace. He was making another mistake, had he but known it, but crawling in under the bedclothes and out of sight. For this meant he was letting slip a chance of seeing something that would have given him a new viewpoint. This night and the night before, had he been up and about, he would have seen ghostly shapes flitting around the mound of Nimrud, coming and going in company, with the sound of stones being softly cracked together. All night long, as Lawyer slept, slinking figures came and went in pairs. Were they robbers of Egyptian kidney? If so, what could they be looking for? Lawyer must have been an unusually charming man. The third morning, going up to the mound, he ran into the captain who had delivered the order to desist and engaged him in conversation. The captain became confidential. Very privately, he told Lawyer that he and his men, on the Pasha's orders, had worked like dogs for two nights, collecting gravestones from the nearby village cemeteries to replant them all on the Mount of Nimrod. "We have destroyed more real tombs of the true believers in making sham ones," said the captain, "than you could have defiled between Zob and Salamaya. We've killed our horses and ourselves carrying these accursed stones." But Lawyer didn't. This is almost anticlimactic. Before Lawyer could devise of a means of coping with this astonishing development, the Pasha himself was clapped in jail. The fate which usually sees to it that despots are short-lived had worked the Pasha's downfall. The Turkish government was summoning him to account for his misdeeds. Lawyer found him in a miserable room with the ceiling dripping rain. "Thus it is with God's creatures," the Pasha complained. "Yesterday all those dogs were kissing my hands and feet." And looking at the damp ceiling, he added, "Today everyone and everything falls upon me, even the rain." With the Pasha off the scene, Lawyer's work could proceed without hindrance. One morning, the diggers, all excited and jabbering, rushed out of the pits in the northwest sector of the mound. They waved their shovels, they shrieked and danced. Their furor was a wonderful mixture of fear and joy. "Hasten, obey," they cried. "Hasten to the diggers, for they have found Nimrud himself. Wallah, it is wonderful, but it is true. We've seen him with our own eyes. There's no God but God." Lawyer hurried to the spot. Let me skip over. The news of the find, more or less frightening to the Arabs, spread quickly. The Bedouins came from far and near to see. The sheikh appeared with half his tribe in tow to celebrate the occasion with bursts of rifle fire. It was a glittering fantasy in honor of a world lost since times primeval. The Arabs rode up to the diggings, took one look at the gigantic image, bleached and scored by the watery erosion of millennia or thousands of years, then lifted their arms and cried out to God to witness. The sheikh needed a great deal of reassuring before he'd consent to stepping down into the hole to see for himself that the likeness was not a god risen out of the bowels of the earth. He stared and finally said, "This is not the work of men's hands, but those infidel giants of whom the prophet, peace be with him, has said that they were higher than the tallest date tree. This is one of the idols which Noah, peace be with him, cursed before the flood." Meanwhile, one of the Arab workmen, having dropped his tools in terror, had rushed off to Mosul. There his report that the great Nimrod had risen out of his grave created vast excitement in the marketplace. The caddy interested himself in the matter. He called in the workmen for interrogation. What had been found? The bones, the skeleton of Nimrod, his likeness, something made with human hands. The caddy, or the equivalent of the mayor, went into consultation with the mufti, who reviewed the incident from the theological point of view to determine whether Nimrod should be considered one of the faithful or a dog of an unbeliever. The governor, successor to the tyrannical Muhammad Pasha, made a decision worthy of Solomon. He ordered Layard to handle the remains with propriety and, for the time being, suspend further excavation. Layard managed to get an audience with the governor and was able to convince him that the feelings of the true believers would not be wounded by additional digging. Shortly afterward, a firman or official Turkish permit finally arrived from the Sultan in Constantinople. This finally relieved him permanently of all annoyances stemming from the local authorities and the rabidly Orthodox Arab tribesmen. Now, what did he see when he heard the spot? Hope lent speed to his steps. Not for one moment did he believe that the natives had really found an image of Nimrod. Yet, secretly remembering Bada's successes, he couldn't curb all high expectation. He had another one of those splendid man-headed lions, or had another one of those splendid man-headed lions been found in the rubble like those that Bada had discovered at Nineveh? Then he saw the powerfully sculptured torso, the gigantic head of a winged lion carved in alabaster. It was an admirable preservation, he writes. The expression was calm yet majestic. The outline of the features showed freedom and knowledge of art scarcely to be looked for in the works of so remote a period. Today we know the figure represented was one of the four astral gods that were identified with the four cardinal points of the compass. I'll tell you, they were known in other ways too. According to the Assyrian tradition, Marduk was shown as a winged bull, Nebo as a winged human being, Nergal as a winged lion, and Ninib as a winged, obviously, eagle. You remember the images of the cherubims? You remember the cherubims guarded the Garden of Eden? And in the memory traces right on down would be the memory of those fearsome beings. Here are images guarding what subsequently is proven to be the great temple in that area. Layard was profoundly impressed. I used to contemplate, he wrote, for hours these mysterious emblems and muse over their intent and history. To skip along, Layard's most trying problem was how to send a pair of these colossal, and they were colossal, winged statues back home to London without doing them injury. The summer had ended in a bad harvest and robber gangs were expected to be prowling. Layard decided to expedite the work. The day came when a large gang of Arabs and Chaldeans shoved, tugged, and wrenched a gigantic cart over a half-rotted pontoon bridge to the site. This cart Layard had ordered to be hurriedly knocked together in Mosul. A pair of mighty water buffalo harnessed to the vehicle could hardly budge it. For the first shipment, Layard had chosen a bull and a lion, two of the best-preserved specimens, also two of the smallest. In order to get just one bull out of the mountain of rubble, Layard's workmen had to dig a trench 90 feet long, 16 feet wide, and up to 22 feet deep from the place where the find was located to the rim of the mound. While Layard was becoming frantic with worry, the Arabs were having the time of their lives. They were quite different from the Egyptian, who, when they were rafting their dead kings down the Nile, sang mournful dirges. The Arabs dug with a merry will and let out ear-splitting roars of delight. The colossus was hauled forth on rollers amid a din of approbation. That evening, the first step in the project being accomplished, Layard rode home with Sheikh Adur-ar-Rahman. He records a speech that the Sheikh made that night. Wonderful. Wonderful, there's surely no God but God, Muhammad is his prophet. I'll skip the rest of his speech as he speaks of Noah and the deluge. And for 1,200 years, true believers have been settled in this country, and not one of them ever heard of the palace underground. But lo, here comes a Frank from many days' journey off and walks up to the very place and takes a stick. Are you listening? Germans, Franks, English, Swiss. Will you write that down and remember who does this? Germans, Franks, Irish, Swiss. You know who's the guy who discovered the Hittite Empire? Sace gave the lecture. He and a missionary named Wright wrote later things. Sace built upon what Wright did. Sace gave the lecture. Wright discovered it, came up with the identification. He was an Irish missionary. Call it an accident. How come a Chinaman didn't dig it up? How come an African didn't dig it up? I didn't write the history. 1800. How come it wasn't 1600? What did the Arabs do to the pyramid? Remember who discovered the real nature of it? Night fell, and at the mound of Nimrod, the sheiks and commotion continued unabated. The success celebrated with music, dancing, and the crash of cymbals. Huge and pale, the winged bull looked out upon an alien world. The following morning, the transport to the river began. The buffalo refused to pull such an outsized load. Lyard sought help, and the sheik loaned him more men, equipped with ropes, and rode on ahead with Lyard to clear the way. Behind the leaders danced drummers and fifers, making a hellish noise with their rude instruments. The cart followed, dragged by about 300 men, Lyard writes, all screeching at the top of their voices and urged on by their bosses and superintendents. The procession was closed by the women, who kept up the enthusiasm of the Arabs by their shrill cries. The sheik's horsemen performed divers feats round the group, dashing backwards and forwards and charging with their spears. Twice the cart bogged down. The actual loading onto the raft brought more sweat. The downriver transport that he had already shipped home to England had not been half the problem of these giant statues. The Mosul shippers, who had never in their lives rafted anything as far as Basra, wrung their hands and positively refused to commit themselves to such adventurous undertaking. Had not a certain Baghdad skipper or shipper been threatened with jail on account of his debts, the pieces might very well be there yet. Even so, Lyard had to pay through the nose for special consideration. He made it. That's the important thing. Eventually, the statues were carried down to the Persian Gulf with none of the mishaps that beset Bada's shipment, and the gigantic effigies, winged man beasts, began their long journey downriver after some 28 centuries in oblivion. On a raft that traveled 600 miles down the Tigris, 2,000 more miles over two oceans in the 1800s, around the length of Africa, the Suez Canal had not opened yet until 1869, to London, where they found a new home in the British Museum. You maybe want to see them when we go there. Think you can put it on the itinerary, Ken? Before Lyard temporarily left the diggings, he made another last tour inspection, notebook in hand. I'll skip what he wrote about it. Having taken the digs out of the mound and shipped them all finally away, he wrote, we looked around in vain for any traces of the wonderful remains. And as I walk around here, he said, I'm half inclined to believe we've dreamed a dream, but he didn't. The scientific world, who resented him, credited him with an accident of that dig. He moved in the fall of 1849 to the mound of Kujunjik on the banks of the Tigris across from Mosul. Another had dug there unsuccessfully. Lyard there found the greatest palaces of Nineveh. After 4 weeks' work, he opened up 9 chambers of the palace of Sennacherib. who ruled 704 to 681 B.C., the Sennacherib, who besieged Jerusalem in Hezekiah's day. To skip on, he dug up the greatest find of all was when he dug up the library of Assurbanipal. To use the term library to describe these rooms is not at all far-fetched, as Assurbanipal, who ruled from 688 to 626 B.C., who ascended the throne through the influence of his grandmother Nakia, one time favorite of Sennacherib, was the exact temperamental opposite of the tyrant Sennacherib. His inscriptions, though overweening in phrase as his predecessors, voice peaceable sentiments and generally reflect Assurbanipal's inclination toward the tranquil life. He made a name for himself that will endure through all time by founding his famous library, quote, in one of the tablets he gave the reason, in order that he might have that which to read. The discovery of these tablets was Layard's great excavational and last great excavational triumph. After this, he handed the torch to others, returned to England, embarked on his political career. Assurbanipal's library provided a key to the understanding of the whole Assyrio-Babylonian civilization. The collection had evidently been arranged according to a definite system. The king obtained part of the tablets from private sources, but the largest section consisted of copies he had made of originals scattered throughout all the provinces of his realm. To Babylon he sent Shadanu, one of his officials, with the following instructions, quote, "The day that you receive my letter, take Shuma, his brother, Bel-Iter, Apla, and the artist of Borsippa, whom you know, and collect the tablets, as many as there are in their houses, and as many as there are in the temple of Azida. Seek out and bring to me the precious tablets for which there are no transcripts extant in Assyria. I have just now written to the temple overseer and the mayor of Borsippa that you, Shadana, are to keep the tablets in your storehouse, and that nobody shall refuse to hand over tablets to you. And if you hear of any tablet or ritualistic text that is suitable for the palace, seek it out, secure it, and send it here." End quote. A battery of scholars and writing artists were in Assurbanipal's employ. With their aid, this was all under those mounds. With their aid, he amassed a library containing the total knowledge of his times. This fund of information was strongly colored by different kinds of magic. Most of the books are made up of material having to do with the arts of exorcism, divination, and conducting rites. Some medical works, also philosophical, astronomical, mathematical, and philological. On the mound of Kayunjik, Layard found the school text that gave so much help in deciphering the Class III cuneiform writings, which was the remainder one of those that Rawlinson and Grotefend had worked with and weren't sure of. The library also contained dynastic or king lists, historical sketches, palace edicts of a political nature, and even a poetical literature consisting of epic mythical tales, songs, and hymns. The number of tablets was written down here somewhere into the thousands. Thousands of tablets brought out of this library, never before available and never before to be read without the previous breaking of the codes. I can't find the number. I'll find it some other time. But the key find for biblical scholars initially. Remember this. It got so much attention. This is the prelude to what I've been reading everything about. Among the purely literary tablets were those recording the first great epic of world history, the saga of the terrible and splendid Gilgamesh. This Gilgamesh epic is the most significant work produced by the Mesopotamian civilization. These particular tablets were only partially discovered primarily Balliard's assistant, I've already told you, brought to Britain. And there George Smith, the next man in the sequel, begins to read them, and there are fragments, and he discovers that it is a parallel story of the flood of Gilgamesh, who went looking for the secret to eternal life and found the old man named in the epic Utnapishtim. The friendly god Ea in a dream had revealed the god's punitive intent to Utnapishtim, Ea's protege, whereupon Utnapishtim decided to build himself an ark. What I had loaded thereon, the whole harvest of life, I caused to embark within the vessel, all my family and my relations, the beasts of the field, the cattle of the field, I made them all embark. I entered the vessel, closed the door, and when the young dawn gleamed forth from the foundation of heaven, a black cloud arose. All that is bright turned into darkness. The brother seeth his brother no more. The folk of the skies can no longer recognize each other. They fled. They climbed into the heaven. The gods crouched like a dog on the wall. For days and nights, wind and flood marched on. The hurricane subdued the land. George Smith, reading those fragments, knew he had found a parallel story predating the record of the Bible. Utnapishtim was Noah. I believe Gilgamesh was Nimrod. And yet he came apart because major portions of the fragments were missing. And what was worse, the conclusion of the story was missing. Well, I've already anticipated, George Smith persisted to go back. He went back and brought home 300, he found all of them, like a jigsaw puzzle. 384 fragments enabling him to completely put together the Gilgamesh epic. I'll save that. It got so much attention, and the king's list got so much attention, nobody paid any attention to this. So I tell you, why get these books and read them? I'll read the parts and fit them together. In the ninth year of Hosea, the king of Syria, this is 2 Kings 17:6. Now just remember, you know where I left you? And I didn't find the figure, but literally thousands of inscriptions came out of that library. You got that? But Gilgamesh and the king's list were the center of attention. You got to understand, and these great monuments, awe-inspiring, that go back to imagery put in the minds of man and passed on of the cherubims. And in the vision of Ezekiel, he knew how to recognize them. So Bible history reads in 2 Kings 17:6, see a whole world paying no attention to the little peripheral fragments. That's the point I'm making. Don't want to insult your intelligence. You got it? Now we have found Celts, tribes appear north of the Caucasus in the 7th century B.C., late half of the 8th, early 7th. We know that the tribes of Israel disappear, and we have Esdras saying they move through the headwaters of the Euphrates to a land called Ar-Sereth, which means hill or city of Sereth. We've been finding the clues. Now listen. 2 Kings 17:6, in the ninth year of Hosea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Hala and in Haber by the river of Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. Now the Medes were pressing in on the Assyrian Empire. The tribes of Israel were placed as a buffer and in the cities of the Medes. Bible history of this major part of Israel ends here, except among the prophets. The prophets in the New Testament promise an increase in numbers, great blessing, and eventual restoration. During the last 100 years, a number of archaeological teams have been working in the Middle East. They have unearthed and published the original contemporary accounts. Here's the way some of these inscriptions look. Can you get in close enough? Roll up here, Peter, if they can't. Well, he's doing all right. I wish you could pick up the inscriptions. Let's try it on this camera. Roll on up close. Now, if you listen, there are times I have to do something in a gestalt, in the whole picture. And I have to give you the picture of the long work, yet all compressed into a 1843, 1856, late 1800 period, where they uncover all at once in these various places and uncover the inscriptions at Behistun and uncover the parallel languages, and finally they learn how to read the cuneiform. And now hundreds of scholars have been working on these uncovered fragments. Just see, they're just fragment after fragment. Though he had enough to know he had the Epic of Gilgamesh, a parallel to the flood story, he had to go back, and luckily, they say, he found 384 fragments to finish that story. Thousands of other fragments. Because of the Gilgamesh epic and the king lists, all the scholars concentrated there and shoved the other things aside. It's like a stamp collector. He grabs the gems and shoves the little 2 and 3 and 5 cent stuff aside. You can look at that anytime. The tablets found were at Nineveh and the regions around in 1900 and published in 1930. Their relevance to the lost tribes was overlooked then because they were found in complete disorder, and here's the number I was looking for, and amongst about 1,400 other texts in multiplied hundreds of fragments to be assembled. 1,400 texts comprised thousands of fragments. Gilgamesh is one text. And he had enough to be able to read it. But he had to finish it by finding 384 other fragments. You got to do the jigsaw puzzle first, then transcribe. So they put their attention on key king's lists, Gilgamesh. The relevance of these to Israel is they were in complete disorder among 1,400 other texts, thousands of fragments. The tablets having greatest relevance to the lost tribes were what were called Assyrian frontier post reports. You understand me? What great scholar is going to make his name in the scientific world translating frontier post reports, like the record of a sentry on duty? You understand me? If you're going to race in scholarship from which professorship chairs are appointed, you go to the things that interest the scientific world. Who in the scientific world is looking for Bible confirmation? These Assyrian frontier posts, dated about 707 B.C., describe the activities of a people called the Gemara, who lived in the land of Gamir. The description of Gamir describes the area in which the Israelites had been placed just a few years earlier. One tablet stated that when the king of Urartu came into the land of Gamir, his army was routed as the Gamira counterattacked, entered the land of Urartu, and killed their commanders. Now that'll leave that little frontier thing aside for a moment. The first archaeological evidence to establish a chronological link between Assyria and Israel are found on inscriptions on the site of a limestone stele found at Nimrud, known as the Black Obelisk, dug up in the same place where I've been reading. This inscription says, now this was long ago found in relationship to the transcription of the frontier post inscriptions. This stele I've read to you before, as well as Sargon's inscription of taking Samaria, the key city after the sixth king of Israel, Omri, was named the king, was the name of the king. He built the city Samaria into the capital of the nation. And when the Assyrians took it, they called the people of Israel the son or house of Omri, pronounced with a harsh guttural Comri or Comri. And in the Assyrian records, the house of Israel, the 10 tribes carried into bondage, were never called Israelites, never called anything by them initially except Beth Comri. That goes back to the black obelisk. The inscription tells that prior to them being taken into bondage, they were giving tribute. The inscription is a picture of an Israelite king, Jehu, bringing tribute to the Assyrian king. And it reads, "This is Jehu, the son of Kumri." Omri in Hebrew begins with the consonant agin, formerly called gayin, which was pronounced with a guttural ha, H sound. That is ka or ka. The Israelites would have naturally pronounced Omri as Kumri, which became Kumri in Assyrian. You don't go very far to figure out they become the Gemiru, the Gemiri. As this inscription was executed nearly a century before the captivity of the Israelites, we know why the secular historians found no mention of the exiled Israelites in ancient records. It was simply because the Assyrians, who took the Israelites captive, did not call them by that name. The Gemiri were the same people who about 30 years later, during the reign of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, again were called Kimira. We find in another and later frontier Assyrian tablet that in the second year of the reign of this same king, Esarhaddon, which would be about 679 B.C., that Kimira, under a leader named Teuspa, sought freedom by moving north. Now we got another confirmation from Frontier Post records. Not only Esdras says they moved north, now this record, they moved north under a leader named Teuspa. These were published in 1930, no attention being paid to the thousands of fragments. Do you understand how recent this confirmation of Esdras' statement? The Kimira, under a leader named Teuspa, sought freedom by moving north. But the Assyrian army pursued them into the upper Euphrates district. Nevertheless, they reported a large number of the Israelites, or Kimira, escaped to the shores of the Black Sea. The Greeks on the other side record the same activity, including an invasion of Sardis, the capital of Lydia, in 645 B.C. In their records, they refer to the Kimerarii, or the Cimmerian. You take each syllable, Kimera, Kimeriawa, or you put on it like Hawaii, Kimerioi, which eventually becomes Sumerians or Kimerians. And your present dictionaries will tell you you have the alternate pronunciation of the Kimri in Scotland, or Wales rather, the Kimri or the Cymri. Now, nobody could identify previously who were the Sumerians or Kimerioi. You oink it like a pig at the end. That the Greeks talked about until these Assyrian frontier posts, who were guarding the area where the Israelites were settled, referred to them as the land of Gamir and the Gemira, and Beth Kemera, or Beth Comri. About 600 B.C., the Lydians drove the Gemara, or Sumerians, It took the Frontier Post tablets to put the geography and the time and the people together, that the Sumerians and the Kimri and the Gamra and the Beth-Kumri were the same. About 600 B.C., the Lydians drove the Gamra, or the Sumerians, out of Asia Minor, where they settled in the Carpathian regions west of the Black Sea. That means they went north through the Caucasian, and in this journey where they attacked Lydia, they were driven across the Dardanelles around the Black Sea that way, settling in the area near Ar-Sareth. We also know now, as a result of these digs in Assyria, what happened to a larger body of the Gamra or Beth-Kumri or Israelites that didn't escape the Assyrians. Some of them formed an alliance with Esarhaddon, the king, when he came under attack of the Medes and the Persians. Now we're going to find out the happening as Assyria begins to fall into nothing. This treaty allowed, all dug up, now found since 1901 and 1930, this treaty allowed the Israelites to establish colonies in Sakasini, traced to the sons of Saka, naming it in their own name, colonies in the north and Bactria in the east. Having moved northwards and with no help from the Israelites, Assyria fell in 612 B.C. Soon the Israelites themselves came under pressure from the Medes, and those that had settled in Sakasini moved north to join the other tribes through the Dario Pass into the steppe regions of South Russia. There they came to be known by the Greek name Scythians, which was but the Greeks putting a name on people they didn't know, which was a Greek name that is the synonym of nomad. All the Greeks did was call them barbarian nomads, barbarian Scythians. The Scythians were the Sakasini, Sumerian, Beth-Kumri that had gone through the Dario Pass through the Caucasus Mountains to settle in the area, keep all their belongings and their wagons, own no land, as pointed out by Herodotus. And the Scythians were the Sumerians, were the Sakasinis, were the Beth-Kumri, were none other than the 10 tribes of Israel, or the remnants thereof, moving north after the breakdown of the Assyrian Empire and the growing strength of the Medes, who forming the alliance with the Persians, being stronger than the Persians at first, the first horn on the head of the ram, but later on the Persians become stronger, the power shifts to the south, but the tribes are north of the Caucasus and have gone around the Black Sea and settled in the Carpathian Mountains around the Danube, and the Sumerians and the Scythians begin to separate into tribes, with Bulgaria becoming the home of the Sumerians, the Jetai and the Moaxes, worshiping one Zalmoxes, Chief Moses, and the Scythians, the tribes to the north of the Caucasus Mountains, literally begin to put pressure on the Sumerians that had settled in Bulgaria, and these combined nomads, the Sumerians, the Scythians, known as the Celts, who originated in the same area, are those who bring the culture called Celtic into Europe and into Ireland and into England and into Scotland. History leaves no alternative but to ask the question, why is God bringing this knowledge on the scene at what appears to be almost an exact convergence of time in history, some 2,500 years plus a very few after 722 B.C. when they fall into bondage? Now, how do they get hooked up with Zara? That takes care of the lost tribes north of the Black Sea, west of the Black Sea, north of the Caucasus. How do we identify the Celtic tribes now? Who were the Milesians? Who were the Tuatha De Danann? Who were the Franks, the Visigoths? Who were the Vikings? And who were the Germans? And who were the Danes? And who were the Scandinavians? I'm not as interested in dangling right now as I am in identifying, but it's 1220. Can I leave you north of the Caucasus? Huh? And get back to Gilgamesh some other time? I want to ask you all a question. Do you see any reason for not believing that those 10 tribes are those Scythian, Sumerian, Cimmerian, Celts north of the Caucasus Mountains and in ancient Bulgaria? Now, if they were there, and if the Celts, I don't need to find a British Israelite to trace the Celts to that area. If the Celts came from that area, then we sure don't have to create somebody else to find the Celts. They were it. Crossing the Dan, the Danube, the Dnieper, the Dniester, to build their Dans and their Duns and the Donegals of Ireland. I'm going to quit right here. I didn't dangle anything except the things that were already dangling. Hold it a minute. I told you I remember where I leave people. We don't have to go back to the one-eyed Pasha now. We know what happened to him. He went to jail lamenting his hard luck. And I don't know who fixed his teeth in jail. Do you understand what I'm telling you? That out of these thousands and thousands of fragments, not a line making a lie of God's word, but every record strengthening it. Do you understand what is being said? And furthermore, the link, finally the missing link in the frontier posts and the fragments of simple military reports of the bored guards forced to guard a frontier post where those unruly Israelites were settled. The way they pronounced their name, you had to gag to say it. Beth Klamra. The missing link found. For the tribes that become the Celts, that give the culture across Europe, that blows asunder the old Germanic fixation, that Greece and Rome spawned everything. But we got to find the Davidic line, the son of David, to find a throne over some of these tribes that he can rule over. Now, I don't want some of you to go simple-minded on me and think that it's all solved. No, it isn't. The Tuatha De Danann were conquered by the Miletians. Now, who were the Miletians? Talking about Ireland. The Tuatha De Danann were conquered by the Miletians. The Miletians came up from Iberia. They were all conquered later by the Vikings, the Normans. Who were the Anglo-Saxons? Now, don't you go simple on me, folks. All I did was work backwards to the fact that there was a 7th century beginning north of the Caucasus Mountains. There was a 7th century ending south of the Caucasus Mountains. The ending south of the Caucasus Mountains were the 10, quote, lost tribes. The beginning north was the Celts who break down into. Where the Vikings come from? We now know, typical of these people, that historic people are made divine. as Zalmoxes becomes God. Do you know the source of Odin among the Scandinavians? Their god. We know that the Tuatha De Danann were turned into gods and now all occupy the Shes underneath the ground. Somebody says to me here, very interesting, from Alameda, I'm German, I wonder where I come in. Well, you know where the word German comes from, don't you? It's the cognate of the Latin word for genuine. And it was a Roman designation of a genuine group, no tie-in at all to the stupidity of Nazi Aryanism of the Nazis. But the original German stock themselves were pushed from that Central European area to settle in the area, called Germans by the Romans to distinguish them as the genuine members of a certain group. I'm not going to tell you what the group was. Now we got to get the Miletians straightened out in Iberia. Let me give you a clue. You have to go very far to link Iberia and Eber together. Ask Doc if he's familiar with the magazine, The Biblical Archaeological Review. Yes, I am. Would he like a subscription? Like a hot fudge sundae? Yes, I would. Santa Clara says, Brother Dangler, how much more intellectual chaos before we enter the pyramids again? Well, that's another try. Is that going to get you any faster there than the other ones you did? How do we get a king of David's line up there where the Tuatha De Danann are and where Brutus has arrived from Troy? Get your camera, get it out of here. Don't even want you even close to me. Don't trust you guys. If Darda the Egyptian, son of Zara, was Dardanus the Egyptian, founder of Troy, and if Chalcol was the Egyptian blank or blank and the contemporary founder of blank and blank, and if blank, the brother of blank, was likewise the contemporary Egyptian blank. Do you understand that Jacob and his sons were the relatives of the most powerful man in Egypt? Do you understand that? Until a king rose up who knew not Joseph. They were the power family of Egypt. Now, if Darda, the Egyptian, son of Zara, was Dardanus, and that's what Josephus calls him, the Egyptian founder of Troy, and if Chalcol was the Egyptian blank or blank and the contemporary founder of blank and blank, and if Heman, the brother of blank, was the likewise contemporary Egyptian blank who inherited blank, and if Mahal, the son of Zerah, and the father of these famous Egyptians was blank or blank blank, the blank ancestor of the Miletians, whose record full and complete enable us to blend the whole into one continuous recital, we have the means at hand in the excavations at Troy and blank and blank and blank sources to continue out the record of the sacred chronicles and find the link that claims the throne of David through this Zerah's line to the house of Israel and the proving up of God's word. Do you want to know what these blanks are? Well, come back next time.